There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
You want to
keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. Welcome to a special weekend edition. This is podcast number 399. Saturday special podcast, F1 Weekly visits classic Team Lotus in Norfolk, England.
He won 7 world championships and changed Formula One from a gentleman's sport into a $3 billion business. Before Chapman, Britain was the outsider. After Chapman, only Britain counted.
As an individual, Chapman was a complete firebrand, a complete original. He created an era. His way of thinking dominated racing for years to come.
Nass, welcome to the studio.
Thank you, sir. Hello to everybody. First of all, I would like to thank Ms. Sapphire Nichols of Classic Team Lotus and our longtime listener and friend Peter Brazier for making this possible. In the first part, we will have my conversation with Clive Chapman, son of Lotus founder Colin Chapman. And in the second part, we have a chat with Bob Dance. This gentleman prepared cars for Jim Clark and other great legends that drove for this fantastic team. As you know, Mr. Rogers, in the history of motor racing, there are many names that will live forever. Alfa Romeo, Auto Union, Bugatti, Maserati, and of course, Lotus. The black and gold JPS Lotus is a classic for all times. Colin Chapman was one of the great original thinkers of Grand Prix motor racing. Moss, Clark, Hill, Rin, Fittipaldi, Peterson, Andretti, and Senna all won in Lotus F1 machinery. His son Clive is now preserving the rich heritage of this great mark. I would like to thank him very much for his time and sharing wonderful memories. How many school kids can claim they were picked up from a school by a Formula One world champion? It's a lot of fascinating stories from him. And they also have a very nice website, which I would encourage our listeners to visit. It's www.classicteamlotus.co.uk, and please take a look. So once again, thank you to everybody, and hope our listeners enjoy this conversation.
Okay, folks, we are in serious British racing green territory with Mr. Clive Chapman of Classic Team Lotus. Sir, a great pleasure and honour to be here. How are you today?
Good, thanks. A little bit cold in the old workshops as autumn's approaching, but we're in good shape.
Good. Before we go back to the rich history of this mark, please tell us about what's happening at Classic Team Lotus and what's the main reason for establishing this team?
My family has a collection of cars that I wanted to restore and maintain, look after, and we set up Classic Team Lotus and decided to offer our services to other owners around the world. And I was fortunate enough to be able to hook up with a number of the original Team Lotus mechanics who based in the original workshops at Hethel next to the car factory. We provide our services, as I say, to owners in Australia and Japan and America and Europe, obviously, as well, to restore and maintain and then take the old Lotus F1 cars racing.
Okay. Lotus 38 chassis number 1 took part in only one race, thousands of miles away from home. Please tell our listeners about this race and the winning driver.
Well, it's the greatest race, and it was won by the greatest driver, I'd like to think. Jimmy, it was his third attempt, and I think when Team Lotus first arrived at Indy, there was a certain amount of kind of understandable reaction, negative reaction from the locals, if you like. And Jimmy, by the time 1965 came around and he won, yeah, I think genuinely the Americans were as pleased as anybody to see Jimmy win, because he'd created such a great impression with his sense of sportsmanship. and accepting the circumstances in which he didn't win in 63 and 64. And it actually all came good in 65. It was good news all round.
I understand this car is home these days, and we had the pleasure of looking at it. What is the plan in terms of restoration and possibly running this car in some historic events?
The car belongs to the Henry Ford in Detroit, and it's the most extraordinary museum that myself and Bob Dance went to earlier this year. And the Henry Ford has taken the decision to share the car with the Europeans, I guess, and send it over and displayed it at Goodwood Festival last July. And we've done an initial review and report on the car and presented it to them. They're coming to see us next week with a view to deciding what to do in terms of either preserve it in its existing condition or to make it run again, possibly for Goodwood next year.
Now, one of your world championship and Indy 500 winning driver, Graham Hill, he discouraged his son from going into motor racing, saying Damon was too smart to be a racing driver. What was your dad's approach to your interest in racing, if you had any, in trying to become a racing driver?
Well, he knew I was too smart because I got a mechanical engineering degree where he only got a civil engineering degree. But other than that, he steered me into powerboats. And I raced in powerboats from about 15 until age 22, and then called it a day. And by then, I think I felt I'd rather miss the boat on going circuit racing. And had great fun in powerboats and won the championship, and it was a big adventure. But I do rather regret not having had more determination to follow that course after powerboating. And I really do admire Damon immensely, particularly given that his circumstances were much more challenging than mine. But he didn't let that deflect him from his target, and he went on to become a very worthy world champion.
Now, growing up in a house full of rich motor racing history, apart from Lotus and Lotus drivers, were there other cars or F1 drivers that you thought were, you know, very good, or as a kid growing up, you had some heroes?
No.
Okay, that's very easy. Okay, Enzo Ferrari.
It was just Lotus. It was Lotus or Lotus, frankly, and I'm a bit tunnel visioned like that.
Okay. Enzo Ferrari and your dad are two of the greatest contributors to Formula One and motor racing in general. What is your earliest memory of your dad's passion for motor racing?
I think just getting to the circuits, you know, leaping in his plane and flying from Hethel to whatever circuit in Europe, and getting the hire car and driving at ridiculous speeds towards the circuit, and then arriving and almost always having a fight with the people on the gate, and barging in and being smuggled into the pits, and it, which isn't really much to do with motor racing, but it does demonstrate his passion to a degree. He was just a 100 mile an hour kind of guy who never liked to be told what he couldn't do, and always enjoyed applying his intelligence and his genius to making the most out of any situation. So it was passionate, not just at the circuits, but, you know, away from the circuits, the family life and holidays. It was always flat out.
Mr. Colin Vanderveld was obsessed with beating those bloody red cars. Was winning the only option for your dad, or did he also have Ferrari as his target?
I think Ferrari was the car that he was really interested to beat. He was principally interested in winning. But he certainly had a respect for Ferrari and Mr. Ferrari.
From Moss to Mansell, many great drivers drove for your team. Can you please share some thoughts on drivers you got to know personally? Any stories, any, you know, like of human element that you can share with our listeners?
My big hero was Elio De Angelis, who was with the team when my father died. And Elio really stuck with the team at a time when he could easily have moved on. And he was also very generous to me personally, gave me encouragement and advice. And he was a handsome young Italian playboy racing driver with a gorgeous girlfriend, and I was an impressionable teenager and or kind of late teens, early 20s, and he was just all round, top man really, and also did more Grand Prix for Team Lotus than any other driver, which is often overlooked. A really significant figure, and helped the team get back to winning ways after my father died. So definitely important. And Emerson Fittipaldi is another great guy who occasionally now drives his old Lotuses at historic meetings that we prepare for him, particularly the 72. And he has very fond memories of my father and the team in those days. And I remember Emerson as a schoolboy. He picked me up once in school, and that was the ultimate wow. Clive Chapman's just been collected by Emerson Fittipaldi, and yeah. Off we went. And racing at a time when there was also a great sense of fun still. Other drivers, probably Elio and Emerson are the two that really stand out, and Nigel Mansell is often very generous in his recollections of my father and the Chapman family, and that which is always appreciated.
Yeah. No, any time I've spoken to Mansell, Fittipaldi, and as I mentioned, we interviewed Mario Andretti, they speak very, very highly of your dad, which doesn't surprise, knowing for me as a fan how passionate your dad was about motor racing. Now, going back to Elio De Angelis, were you at Österreichring when he won that great race over Keke Rosberg, 82?
No, I wasn't there. I was watching it on the telly, okay. And I remember kind of kneeling on the floor in front of the screen going absolutely mental, and Elio just squeaking it. We've got that car in our collection, 91 Chassis 8, which is Elio's first win and Dad's last win, and so, quite an important car for us. And whenever we run the car in historic F1 occasionally, it always brings back nice memories.
Okay, now, I go through old magazines and old newspapers about motor racing. Elio De Angelis was not happy with Peter Waugh when Ayrton Senna joined your team. He was under the impression that when Mansell would leave, he would become the team leader. And I remember him saying in an interview that this was all the fault of Peter Waugh because he started dancing around Senna. Can you share some thoughts on that, please?
I think Peter Waugh is an honourable man, and I don't think he would have committed himself to something and then gone back on it. Making a commitment and giving an impression is a different thing, two different things. I'm sure that Elio must have found it very difficult when Ayrton came to the team. Ayrton was very different to Elio. At the time, to begin with, Elio really matched Ayrton in a way that very few of Ayrton's teammates have ever managed. And he was leading the championship in front of Ayrton until about two-thirds of the way through the season. So I think the fact that the team leant towards Ayrton, I think, probably came about from Ayrton's extreme attitude towards winning. It consumed him completely, motor racing, whereas Elio was a more sympathetic, with more to life than the motor racing, if you know what I mean. It was sad for all of us, and it must have been very disappointing for Elio. But I'm sure that Peter, as I say, wouldn't have let Elio down on an issue of giving his word.
Now, how did you find Ayrton Senna when he joined your team, both as a person and as a driver?
Well, I didn't know Ayrton particularly well because I was at university and then working in London, so I was away from the team when he was with Lotus. But on the occasions that I did meet him, he was always very polite and expressed an appreciation for Lotus history, and he enjoyed the role of being Lotus number one, always very generous to my mother, who was fulfilling the role of founder, really, in the wake of my father's death. So the mechanics, you know, really rooted for Ayrton big time, because he was, you know, so dedicated to winning and qualifying the number of times that he stuck it on pole when, you know, it seemed beyond him, but he still managed it, and they loved him for that. And Chris Dinnage, who's the team manager here, and Nick Yallop, who's on the race team at Classic Team Motors, they both worked very closely with Ayrton, and Bob Dance, in fact. Mm-hmm. And they have very fond memories of him, in a different way to their memories of, say, Ronnie, for instance. But they really appreciated, because they're all racers, you know, the mechanics, and they really liked Ayrton's singular focus on winning.
His first win, Portugal 1985, classic Grand Prix win. Were you there? Your thoughts on that win?
I wasn't there, but I've seen it on video many times, and remembered watching it on the telly at the time, of course. We have the car, 97 T2, in running condition in the collection, and that's just a very special piece of F1 history. You know, that's the tub that Ayrton sat in and produced that incredible drive, which he nominated as his greatest ever race. Really? Donington as his greatest ever lap. But Estoril was his greatest ever race, and it really was one of those performances. Even though he was miles in front, he still kept up the speed and kept up the pace, because it was those conditions where anything could happen, and you just had to drive, you know, 100%. People who were driving at 95% were just as likely to aquaplane off. A superb result.
Now, your dad was not at Hockenheim in April 1968. Do you recall your dad's reaction, or how you got the news yourself?
Well, I was only 5 years old, so I don't remember it. But I know that Dad was on holiday with the family, and Jim Enderwright, the chief mechanic, gave him the news, and he found it extremely difficult to cope with, because Jimmy was more than an employee, if you like. That's not really the right word, but you know what I mean. He really was a close friend, someone he shared his challenges with, if you like. And I think the team that will tell you, the race mechanics will tell you, that they got the impression that was it. You know, that was the end for Team Lotus, and they didn't really expect to be going Grand Prix racing again. But largely down to Graham Hill, who stepped in to really pull the team through the Spanish Grand Prix, which was the next Grand Prix, and he won that Grand Prix and then went on to win the World Championship. You know, I think that kind of Graham managed to pull the team through that particularly dark period for Dad and through to the other side, and then Dad was able to get going again.
What's the biggest legacy or lesson your dad has left for you, both as a person and as a racing fan?
The collection of cars, actually, is the biggest legacy, because that's ended up being my career.
Yeah.
This is my principal source of earning a living, and certainly it's my principal source of achievement, other than my family and children, of course. I think I've got a bit of a... at times, I display something of his attitude in as much as anything is possible, you know, if you really put your mind to it. I don't seem to have quite his drive and confidence. Certainly, he had a lot of confidence, people will tell you. He had kind of confidence verging on barefaced cheek at times, I think. It's a wonderful thing to work, particularly with the mechanics that worked with Dad on the cars that he designed, and then we go to all the classic Grand Prix circuits with our customers, and even including Monaco every couple of years, and then the Goodwood meetings, you know, and it really is very special, particularly to take my children now and my sister's children to Goodwood, and we have a weekend there, and they see Granddad's cars, you know, winning at the revival or being appreciated by all the fans at the festival. It's a really lovely thing.
Talking of kids and the family, any chance you might see a Chapman driving a race car soon?
Not driving one, I don't think. We've restored my old... I've got a daughter and two boys, and the two boys and I restored my old go-kart recently, and they roar up and down Grandma's Drive in that.
Okay.
And as I say, they're very keen on coming to the events, and they are now working in the workshop now and again, and Bob Dance encourages them. And when they come to the meetings, they try and help out a little bit. And hopefully they'll be engineers rather than racing drivers.
OK. Okay. Now, you know, Peter Windsor, the journalist, I was reading his article, this was in fundraising some years ago, and he said no two people could dislike each other more than Peter Waugh and Nigel Mansell. Your comment on that, please. And this is a fairly well-known fact about the two.
Yeah, it's not something that they're both gentlemen at the end of the day. They haven't mentioned it to me, but I'm sure there was a certain level of antipathy there. But, you know, if you can't think of something nice to say, it's best not to say anything.
Okay. Apart from Lotus fans in the UK, where do you see the most interest or inquiries regarding Team Classic Lotus?
Sorry, can you repeat that question?
Yeah, I'm sure you have a big base of fans here in the
Classic Team Lotus.
Yeah, classic Team Lotus. Yeah. Where do you see interest in your history of your team or cars and, you know, heritage of this organization coming from? My guess would be United States and Japan.
Mainly it's England and Europe, actually. Japan probably next up. The Lotus brand is extremely strong in Japan. Senna was a huge hero. Right. Jim Clark in the 60s, green and yellow. The Lotus Elan is very popular out there. And America is there's a very active owner club in America. And they're kind enough to invite us out to their Lotus owners gathering each year, which is a real treat. And they have a much better gathering in America than we do in England, which just goes to show that the Americans are always good at organising these kind of things. We have a website, and we just do a quarterly review and tell people what we're doing and which events we're going to. And I think that's attracted a kind of a bit of a following. But mainly Lotus owners, Lotus road car owners, are the source of interest in what we're doing, I think. And even the new owners, who may not know much about Lotus history, by a Lotus Elise or a Lotus Evora. And some of them will be interested in the Team Lotus history, and we'll get to know them through that. We do workshop tours, and we sell our merchandising and stuff, and license the scale models. The scale models are really popular, so it all kind of adds up.
Okay. And you mentioned your website, which is very nice. You also have a couple of Formula One cars for sale. Who is your typical buyer?
I'd say someone, anyone can, anyone we like. So 40s, 50s, maybe raced when they were younger, then got a proper job, and maybe, you know, have been successful and are now able to afford the time and the money to actually savour what racing a Formula One car would have been like had they made it as a youngster.
Okay, let me ask you a question. If somebody wants to buy a car which has a significant history for your organisation, would you sell it to a person who is anywhere and is paying the price, or do you want it to go to certain markets so that it can come back, or you may have access to it for whatever reason, a demonstration, or so it can come back to like a Goodwood race? You know what I'm trying to say?
We don't really sell many cars. Okay. The two that we've got on the website are because we've got two of each of them, and we don't need two of each of them. So it's not really up to... I was just joking when I said, you know, as long as they're nice, it's not really up to us to be arbiters of who can own a Lotus F1 car. Most of the cars are bought and sold in the market, and we're not involved. Our main interest is in helping existing owners to maintain and restore and preserve their cars. In saying that, there's a Type 81 on the website for sale at the moment, and the principal motivation for advertising that for sale is in the hope that the owner would want to race it in the historic F1 Championship. So I'm kind of, you know, I suppose, hoping that we can nudge it in that direction, but I wouldn't be arrogant enough to suggest that we can, you know, vet potential owners. So.
Okay. You are planning to create a heritage center for Classic Team Lotus. When can we expect this to be operational?
Yes, good question. And my family has a very significant collection of cars that we've invested a lot in over the last few years with the help of Classic Team Lotus customers. And I'm hoping that Group Lotus Car Company within the next few years will be in a position to establish a heritage centre that we can participate in, and I'm certainly trying to encourage that whenever I get the opportunity. Also, Classic Team Lotus needs a new workshop. We've grown quite significantly over the last 3 or 4 years, and our transporter is almost bigger than our workshop now, so we need to really come up with a modern building. The original workshop from a historical point of view is significant, obviously, and maybe we can keep that as some kind of visitor attraction, but a modern rectangular warm building with all the necessary equipment in is really what we need now. So that's the kind of two parts of it. One, we want to show the cars that we've restored. The other is we need a better working environment.
You mentioned the tours you do. Can you please tell our listeners how long the tour is, and is it all year long, and what can they expect when they come? What can they see when they come here?
Well, basically, we show you the workshops, and it's whatever's in the workshop at the time. At the moment, you've got Jimmy's Type 25, Jimmy's Type 38, we've got my father's Lotus 11, Emerson 72, Mario's 79, Elio's 91. So there's generally something interesting to look at. And we tell you about the cars, and we let people really, you know, get under their skin. We've got the archive of all the original drawings that people enjoy looking at. We give them a bit of a personal insight. I'm normally there, and will introduce Classic Team Lotus and myself to them. But it's quite informal and very low level. It's not it's nothing like going around the McLaren factory. So it's a couple of hours tops, and in the evening when the workshop is closed. It's best to try and dovetail it in with the tour around the Lotus Cars factory, which is on Wednesday afternoons, and then people come to us on Wednesday evenings, and then it makes it something a bit more significant. We had some people came from Manchester the other day, which is about 6 hours drive, and I was a bit nervous throughout the tour, thinking, my God, they've come 6 hours to see this, because it's fairly amateur, really. But no, we've never had any complaints. So,
you know, it may be amateur, but I mean, history is incredible, unbelievable. Final question is, what's your favourite Lotus Formula One car?
I think I'd probably have to go for the 25. Yeah, we're fortunate that we've got two in the workshop at the moment, and there's only two running, and but it's just the most elegant looking car, incredibly simple. And in 1963 there was 10 Grand Prix in the championship, and Jimmy won 7, and it was really, you know, Lotus and Jimmy together, Dad and Jimmy together, combined to create this unstoppable machine, and it just looked so beautiful at the same time. So that's probably the one I'd choose.
Finally, how about a message for listeners of F1 Weekly, please?
Well, I appreciate your interest in F1. I know it's not always the easiest thing to follow in the States in particular. And whenever we're at a historic meeting, we're always impressed by the number of American spectators. And certainly when we go to the Lotus Owners Gathering each year, there's always a lot of questions about Formula 1 and the history of Formula 1. And there's a new series starting over in the States, Historic Motorsport Productions, which Bobby Rahal is involved with. And I think the first race is going to be at the Barber Museum in Birmingham, Alabama, next year, and in May. And the Barber Museum. Have you been to the Barber Museum?
No.
It's the most incredible thing. So if you want to come and see Lotus history and enjoy historic F1, then try and get to the Barber Museum that weekend, because it really would be a treat, I think.
Thank you very much, sir.
Stay tuned for part two, a conversation with Bob Dance.
Okay, folks, I'm here with the gentleman, and if you know anything about motor racing history, especially Lotus, you would know Mr. Bob Dance. Bob, how are you today, first of all?
Yes, fine, thank you. Nice to see you on board here.
Thank you. Please tell us, when was the first time and where did you meet Colin Chapman?
Well, my interest in racing cars go back to the beginning of the 50s. And Colin Chapman came into motor racing around that time with home-built 750 Austin 7 Specials, 750 Motor Club. And he progressed along developing his successful home-built sports cars, and eventually went into production for customers, because they were very competitive cars, very advanced, original thinking, and you know, we used to see his cars running on the track and doing very well.
And when did you join Team Lotus?
I joined Lotus, the Lotus Group, in 1960. I had been to see them prior to that in about 1957, in the days of the Lotus 11s. But I was trained as a garage mechanic, and whilst they would have taken me on, the company was still in its very early stages. They weren't able to pay very much money, and I continued on in my garage work for another couple of years. And when they moved out of their Hornsey buildings into a purpose-built factory just north of London at Cheshunt, that's when I thought I must really see if I can get on board. And I went to talk to them. I'd also built a 750 special, as we called them in the day, and they were able to see my amateur work, and they were quite happy to give me a go. And I started off there in Lotus Components, which built the customer race cars, and I was involved in the Lotus transmissions of the day, the sequential high-speed gearboxes.
Okay, Lotus cars' first victory came through Stirling Moss driving for Rob Walker, and Lotus' own victory came first time in Watkins Glen, 1961. If a Grand Prix was won by a Lotus private entry, would that bother Colin Chapman?
I'm sure he would have preferred to have had his own... Sorry. I'm sure he would have preferred to have his own driver and car win the Grand Prix. But it's, you know, it's pretty good if you can sell a car to a private entrant and he can go and win a Grand Prix. You're really making some good stuff, aren't you?
Now, the first Grand Prix win for your team came through Innes, Ireland. And then when he was let go from the team... For years he had felt bad about being let go by Colin Chapman. Can you reflect on that story a little bit, please?
Yes, Innes was one of these adventurous types, a great character, a playboy, but none the more, you know, a very good driver. But I think that there might have been a clash of temperament with Colin Chapman and Innes at certain points. You know, Innes was a heavy smoker for a start, and Colin wasn't. And Innes would be out partying, and perhaps Colin was thinking, you know, more of the development of his cars and what was going to be happening, you know, the next day, race-wise and that. So, Innes was a great bloke, don't get me wrong. And a lot of the drivers of the day were a similar character. I think it was perhaps to do with the end of World War II and everything. You know, there was quite a lot of men at the loose end of wanted to do something exciting. They'd probably been flying fighter aircraft or... you know, in some fairly dangerous situations, and they got the adrenaline from all of that and had to go motor racing, I think.
When Jim Clark came to Team Lotus, did you know right away he was something special?
I think I didn't know, but I think Colin Chapman had raced against him, because Colin was a very good driver too. You know, he was up with the front runners. And, yes, I think when he was racing against Jim almost a club event between, I think Colin got some idea he was up against a good driver. And Jim had quite a bit of club experience up in Scotland, and he got a test drive with Lotus, and they were very happy to take him on board in Formula Junior. He did a season of Formula Junior in 1960, and you know he was a front runner in that. And it moved on from there. Yeah.
You know what I read, and was completely blown away, that, you know, Ronnie Peterson was always famous for not being a good development driver. And I read that Jim Clark was also not very good in developing cars. Is that true?
I think if the drivers can give the designer and engineer a feeling of what the car is doing or what they'd like it to do, men of the capabilities of Colin Chapman and Glenn Terry, Maurice Philippe, they were able to interpret their words into what the car was actually doing and carry out some adjustments and experiments and come to a compromise where things suited the drivers and their performance improved.
Now, were you at Indy in 1963 when Jim Clark should have won, in 1965 when he did win?
No, I wasn't at Indy, but we were very keen on what was going on, and we listened on shortwave radio to see what was going on. You didn't have the communications then we've got now. And it's not really surprising to understand that the Americans wanted to see their man out in front and winning, but they'd already got quite a shock from the performance of the funny cars from England and the limey mechanics. We were going to change things. I think they could see that because their cars were very heavily built, front-engined roadsters, developed to reliability because it was a long distance race, and they were all of a similar design, so it was down very much to the drivers themselves and their ability.
How do you remember Jim Clark as a person?
As a person? A good friend of the team mechanics, and a very good driver, of course. People would put in 100% effort on preparation of cars because they knew they'd get 100% effort for man behind the wheel. And whilst he didn't notice to that extent, you know, he was trying hard, he was just a smooth driver with some mechanical sympathy. And we got on well together.
Now, I was talking to Clyde, so I want to ask you this question also. What was the problem between Peter Waugh and Nigel Mansell that they could not get along?
I think that comes about from Nigel Mansell was like a working class young man from the Midlands with a Brummy accent, as they call it here.
Right.
And it, you know, it doesn't sound that sharp, that accent. Peter Waugh was public school educated, and at the time we had Elio De Angelis driving for us, and Elio was son of a gentleman, well-educated, refined chap, really, and Peter Waugh and Elio seemed to click okay because they were of similar upbringing. Nigel was in the unfortunate situation that Colin Chapman died about the time when Colin was getting a bit disenchanted with Elio. Because Elio was more of a gentleman driver and, you know, not perhaps what we really wanted in terms of an out-and-out front runner. but none the more a very reliable driver. And I think, but what actually happened was when Colin Chapman died, then Nigel Mansell's chances slipped away, because he had a few things happen to him along the way, and he used to make some excuses, which didn't go down well with the team. But
can you give us an example of an excuse, please?
Well, one of the most famous excuses, and he was doing really well at the time, was the Monaco Grand Prix, and it had been wet, and unfortunately he slipped off when comfortably in control of the race, and he blamed it on a white line on the road. Well, that white line's there for everybody, and he certainly knew it was there and had been over it many times. But you don't have to make an excuse. You know, if you do something wrong, then, OK, you've done it wrong and that's it. I'm sure he learned a lot with us. And when he moved on, we all know that he became a world champion. He was a real charger. A real charger, not necessarily using his brain all the time, I think.
Yeah, I spoke to him last year. We did an interview, and he was very complimentary of Colin Chapman. Now,
he would have been okay, I think, with Colin Chapman, because Colin had got his sights on Nigel, and I'm sure he would have given all the attention he could and advice and everything. And who knows, things would have turned out differently.
Now, you said you did not know that Jim Clark was special when he came to your team. What about Ayrton Senna when he came to your team? Did you think he was special, or he was just another?
Yes, I think most people thought Ayrton was special, particularly after his drive at Monte Carlo in the wet, where we think he would have won that race, but they decided to shorten the race and decided it was too dangerous to continue. So he was denied a possible win there, I think. But when he came to Lotus, yes, he was extremely focused on everything about his car, about the instruments in the car, about what he could do, what he couldn't do. Yes, he was 110% man, and he just wanted to be number one in everything he was doing.
How do you remember him as a person?
He was very pleasant with the mechanics. He had a good sense of humour, and you felt that, you know, if you were working for him, once again, you were working with a winner, and that makes all the difference.
One of my all-time favorites, Ronnie Peterson, drove for your team, and you had known him even before he got to Lotus. Can you talk a little bit about him and your association with him, please?
Yes, I first met Ronnie at March Engineering, and they all thought he was going to be a good lad there. And then he got his chance at Team Lotus, and he was just a naturally good driver. A lot of people say he wasn't particularly good at setting up a car, but if he was in a team and the other driver was good at setting up a car, he'd probably use his settings. Like when he drove with Mario, they'd talk together and Ronnie would say, well, if that suits Mario, it must suit me, and he'd be right up there. Yeah, he was ready to take a win if Mario had a problem, for sure.
And talking of March Racing, we're talking Max Mosley. How did you find him when you worked at March?
Oh, a good chap. Yeah, good for morale. They were a good group of people. Alan Rees was quite a good race driver in his time. Robin Hurd had worked at McLaren. He also did a short period of time in his training from the Royal Aircraft Establishment. He came to Lotus and was working with us in development for a short period, a month or two. And that's how I got to know him, and that's partially how I got to March, because they said, why don't you come and join March? You know, we're going to do this and do that. And in that first year of 1970, well, they used to manufacture a monocoque a week. You can't imagine Lotus with that very refined Lotus 72 of advanced design. You couldn't imagine manufacturing a chassis for that car in a week, but the March 701 was a very simple, straightforward car, and they got a lot of good drivers involved, Mario Andretti. In fact, I looked after Mario's car at March. I'd worked with him at Lotus in 68 and 69, and Mario was, yeah, really, really good person to work with, great character. He'd raced in, well, the 1 mile ovals and the half mile ovals were dirt races in the States, brought up the hard way, and then of course on the Indianapolis circuit, yes, he was a out and out racer.
Great career in motor racing for you. When you look back, give me like a couple of races that stand out for you, and any special moments that you treasure in your memory.
Well, I suppose the memories which are best are the ones you win when you win. It was the 78 season where we won the championship. That was a great season where we'd got an advanced car with the undercar aerodynamics, and we got two first-class drivers, Mario and Ronnie, and they're both keeping each other going. You know, the pressure's on all the time, and that was a great year. There's so many memories along the way.
Yeah. We're out of time. I really appreciate your time. Can you please say a message to listeners of F1 Weekly? We have listeners all over the world, and I'm sure they would love to hear from you.
Right. Well, a message for worldwide listeners. Well, I think we've ended up just about the end of the 2009 season with a British world champion and world champion constructors. So let's hope we can continue that into 2010.
Thank you very much.
Bob Dance, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com, thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport, a blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.